Case number 20-5835, USA versus Quint Davis. Nothing to see, 15 minutes aside. Mr. Shad, are you calling?
Good morning, your honors. May it please the court, I'm here this morning representing Quentin Davis, and I believe I've reserved 3 minutes for a rebuttal, if I may.
Yes.
Thank you, your honors. Officer Stratman violated Mr. Davis's right to remain silent by continuing to interrogate him after he specifically and unequivocally invoked his right to remain silent. The district court got that right in finding that, in fact, what Officer Stratman did was an interrogation. Where the district court erred was, and they took that interrogation, set it aside, and held that the subsequent statements that were made by Mr. Davis were, in fact, voluntarily and knowingly made despite the constitutional violation.
Well, it's a sort of an unusual fact pattern, because after that question was put to Mr. Davis, Mr. Davis asked to speak with officers in a place that was more private, and then there was another Miranda warning and a waiver, at least the district court found at that point. What do you say about that rather unusual sequence?
That is correct. And to add to that unusual sequence, we also have after Officer Stratman made the constitutional violation, he continued without providing Miranda warnings to communicate with Mr. Davis by giving him updates with regards to the case, telling him what they were going to do next with regards to the case, but all before Mr. Davis finally decided to talk with the officers. And I think that's where the problem that is really lied with this case, because, you know, in the Michigan versus Mosley case, what we say is that once a defendant invokes the right to be silent, that right must be scrupulously honored by the officers. And that is the standard that the Supreme Court provided. And in this case, under any rational understanding of what occurred, looking at that fact pattern, there's no way that any court could find that Officer Stratman scrupulously honored Mr. Davis's right to be silent.
Could someone like Davis never decide, maybe it is in my best interest to talk to the officers, and I will, when given a subsequent Miranda warning, waive my rights? Is that impossible then?
It's not impossible, because I think that is part of what Michigan versus Mosley says also, right, is that you can't read Miranda to come to the absurd result that he can never talk to officers again. But he can certainly wait until he gets counsel and then make the decision to speak to officers again. And I think that would be completely acceptable under the Constitution.
No, but acceptable, but absolutely required.
Well, the only two ways in which this can occur is if either he has counsel and he does that, or there is some clear break in events.
You don't think his initiating the request to speak further with officers in a more private place breaks that?
Not given the time frame that we're, you know, perhaps if it was 2 or 3 days down the line, that would be acceptable. But here we have roughly an hour and a half to 2 hours and a half that occurred. And if you take a look at it during that time, take a look at everything that Officer Stratman did during that hour and a half to 2.5 hours. And what we're looking at here is we're looking at whether or not the officers were taking actions to overbear the will of the defendant, in this case, and specifically the right of the defendant to remain silent, which everybody agrees that he clearly invoked his right to remain silent in this case. If this court finds that under this fact pattern, a defendant can, that the district court can use this kind of knowing and voluntary test to determine that, well, it was still a valid waiver despite all of these things occurring, then basically the Miranda protections are meaningless. Because what's to prevent a police officer from doing this in every single case? In this case, we had Well, according to Officer Stratman, and that is the testimony that we have to go on in this case. So he gets to the first location, the first police station, and he reads him his Miranda rights. And according to Officer Stratman, after he reads him his Miranda rights, then he invokes his right to remain silent almost immediately thereafter. We also have the fact that Officer Stratman indicated that during that conversation, he showed him a picture of one of the persons involved in the case, asked if he knew him, asked him another name, and see if he knew her. And so, you know, there's a little bit of a muddled record as to whether those questions occurred before or after he invoked his right to remain silent. However, we have Officer Stratman's testimony, and I believe it's on page 297 of the record, where he says that likely occurred before Miranda, which is a curious statement, because if he was questioning him before Miranda, then that's another violation that the court obviously never got to. But having said that, now we have in the mix that he's asking him, showing him pictures. He's obviously interrogating him. There's a right to remain silent. Shortly thereafter, he comes back to him. He interrogates him again about the money. And again, there are no Miranda warnings given at the time he interrogates him about the money.
None of that evidence was admitted, though. His response to Officer Stratman was excluded, correct?
That is correct. However, I was able to find no case in which a court has parsed out this concept of the constitutional violation where part of the evidence can come in and part of it doesn't come in, and this section is considered tainted and it's considered a constitutional violation and this is not. And that gets me to my whole concern about this is that the reason that Miranda did what it did was because the atmosphere in which Mr. Davis was in is inherently coercive.
Well, you know, this fact pattern is unusual, but it's unusual in that Stratman was really sharing information, occasionally asking a question, but it's really, really different from these situations we see. We've got officers suggesting that cooperating would be to the defendant's benefit. Other things that are much more targeted at eliciting a statement. And so, the adjectives one would use to describe Stratman are not, to my mind, the adjectives that one would typically use to describe officer conduct that's much more serious.
I have two answers to that question, okay. Your Honor. And the first one is that what that presumes is you're excluding the constitutional violation, because we know that Officer Stratman asked him about the money and where he got the money, and that is directly related to the case, and that was in violation of his right to remain silent. So you can't take that off the table and take that off the defendant's mindset when you're deciding whether or not this was a coercive atmosphere or not. You can't simply parse them out and exclude them from one another, especially when they occurred in such a short period of time.
In the later questioning, right?
Pardon me?
Stratman was not involved in the later
questioning. That is correct, Your Honor.
Was he present during the later questioning?
My understanding is he was not. I watched the video on that, which is part of the record in this case, and I don't remember that I saw him in the video, and it was a fairly lengthy video.
So the later questioning was at a different physical location, a completely different building?
That is correct.
Right? So how was he transported between the two? Via car or something?
Some conveyance. Okay. I actually don't know the answer to that.
And then he was given a new Miranda warning there.
He was.
How should that factor in?
Well, I don't think it should factor in at all at this, because of two things. First, because of the time frame that we're talking about here. Again, we're talking about an hour and a half to 2 hour period where a constitutional violation has actually occurred. And number two, he'd already, if we're looking at the concept of did you break down his will? Well, the best evidence of the fact that Officer Stratman took these steps to break down his will is the fact that he finally agreed to talk. even though he had said he wanted to remain silent in the case. The other thing, and going back to your question, Judge Gibbons, is that you can't discount this whole concept of informing Mr. Davis about the facts of the investigation. Of course, why would a police officer continue to provide updates to a defendant who has invoked his right to remain silent, but for the fact that he wants to coerce him into talking about the case? There's no other reason for him to do so. There was nothing that he needed. There was no permission he needed to go into a room. There was no permission he needed to look on a phone. He was providing him updates merely to move the ball along in terms of getting Mr. Davis to talk. There's no other basis to do that. And I would argue that it's even less innocuous than some of the other cases that Your Honor talked about, in which it's, you know, do the right thing or something like that, because in this case, it was direct questioning. Where did you get this money? Where did this money come from? Here's what we're going to do next.
It was just sharing information that the officer might reasonably have thought your client wanted, like the fact that his girlfriend had been picked up.
Well, the test is a reasonable standard, right? So what would a reasonable defendant have believed? Was it reasonably to believe that it was likely to it was likely to turn into an incriminating statement by the defendant, not what Mr. Stratman or Officer Stratman was in fact doing? But the fact is, okay, if you want to say that this officer was just merely providing him multiple updates as to how the case was progressing, I didn't find any other case on point where that was a common police practice either. There was obviously a reason for the officer doing it in this case, and the reason was he had already violated the Constitution and he was continuing on to try to get Mr. Davis to talk. And he, in fact, got what he wanted. He got Mr. Davis to finally relent and talk. And that's the problem in this case. That's why his statements need to be suppressed. I see I have 9 seconds left, unless there are any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, James Chapman for the United States. I'd like to begin by correcting the record on one specific issue that my friend spoke about, and that is about the question about the picture of Mr. Teets at the gang unit. I believe my friend said the record was muddled on that point. I don't believe that's an accurate representation. I believe Officer Stratman testified that he probably showed the picture of Teets before Mirandizing Mr. Davis at the station. That's the proof on that subject.
Was there a finding by the district court or the magistrate judge on that particular issue?
There was, Your Honor.
What was the finding?
The magistrate judge made a factual finding that the image was shown to Mr. Davis before the gang unit Mirandization, and the district court upheld that factual finding twice. First, in its opinion and order, adopting, in relevant part, the recommended disposition, and then on a motion for reconsideration, the district court adopted the finding yet again.
So to clarify the record, the district judge and magistrate judge found that the photo of Teets was shown to the defendant here before the defendant received his first Miranda warning. Then, is that right so far?
That's not precisely correct, Your Honor. Before the Miranda warning at the gang unit. Mr. Davis was Mirandized at the scene of the traffic stop before he was brought to the police station. And so he was Mirandized at the stop. He did not invoke his rights. He arrived at the gang unit. The picture of Teets was shown to him. Then he was Mirandized again.
So he received Miranda warnings three times, not two?
Correct, Your Honor. At the traffic stop, at the gang unit, and then with TFA Baker.
So at the first Miranda warning at the traffic stop, he does not invoke his right to remain silent.
Correct.
He's shown the photo of Teets when he arrives at the gang unit. Do we know what he says about Teets?
I do not believe his response is in the record, Your Honor.
Okay. And then he receives a second Miranda warning at the gang unit. And then he's asked by Officer Stratman about the money. And that questioning and whatever answer he gave is barred by the district court as a violation of the invocation of his right to remain silent. And then later the event, within 2 hours or so, he says, I would like to talk in a quiet place, and then he is driven, is that right, to a different location?
Your Honor, I don't believe the method of transportation is in the record.
But it's not just a different room in the same building.
That's correct. It is a entirely separate location.
And was Stratman present during the second discussion at the second place where Davis does make various confessions?
I believe he was, Your Honor. The second interrogation was led by TFA Baker. I believe the court has seen the video of that, mm-hmm. at least ordered the video.
I just wanted to clarify, because your opponent said he wasn't sure that Stratman was there.
I believe TFA Baker led the interrogation, but there is a second officer in the video, and I do believe that is Officer Stratman.
If we wanted to satisfy the uncertainty about that, how would we know what Stratman looks like and whether he's the officer on that video?
Your Honor, I believe that there is testimony. I cannot cite a page to the court off the top of my head, but I believe there was testimony that Officer Stratman agreed that he was present in that second interrogation. That was either at the suppression hearing or it may have come out during trial.
Are there any cases that have said that it's not a violation of a person's invocation of the right to remain silent for an officer to come in repeatedly and to advise the person being detained of the progress of the case?
There are, Your Honor. Yes.
Would you like to talk about them?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think the best case I can cite for you from the Supreme Court is Arizona versus Roberson. That held that it is not a violation of Miranda for the police officers to provide factual updates about an investigation. This court has applied Roberson in a number of cases. I would point the court to United States versus Hurst, I'm not sure how to pronounce this case name, but Bakninski. There's a pretty consistent line of authority saying that simple factual updates about an investigation are not barred by Miranda. And in fact,
when the defendant has invoked his right to remain silent.
Yes, Your Honor. Because they, at least as a general rule, they are not interrogation. And we actually want to encourage sharing information with defendants in this context. We want, or not even a defendant at this point, just a target of an investigation. We want targets to be able to make fully informed, intelligent, rational decisions about how to progress in their lives. And to do that, police need to be able to share factual information with them.
Isn't it pressuring a potential defendant to be telling them what's going on in the case in terms of, say, hypothetically now, arresting cohorts in crime, giving implications that if you don't confess, your life is going to be harder because we've arrested these cohorts in crime and they're going to be talking to us?
As a general matter, I think the answer is no, Your Honor. Everything in this scenario is a totality of the circumstances inquiry. And so there could, of course, be situations where something the police officer said was so coercive or so out of line that it could cross the line into something that was unduly coercive. But I think as a general matter, simply providing factual updates about a case is not going to be so coercive as to overcome the individual's will. I think the Eighth Circuit has a really good case on this. I cited it in the brief, Hull. The Ninth Circuit, the Hull involved, for instance, a statement to the defendant that the police were about to search his sister's house. Eighth Circuit held that that was not improper. The Ninth Circuit has some good case law cited in our brief. This court, a case called McKinney, held that statements regarding the evidence and possible consequences, including a statement that the defendant could face the death penalty, is not improper. I believe that involves statements about the seizure of 600 pounds of cocaine and a statement that the defendant was, quote, in serious trouble. So, again, I think as a general overarching matter, these sort of statements are consistently held to not be problematic. Your Honor, I'm happy to speak through the Mosley factors for a few minutes. The first factor is whether the police immediately ceased the interrogation upon Mr. Davis's invocation of his right to remain silent. Here, Officer Stratman did. Upon Mr. Davis's invocation at the gang unit, Officer Stratman left him alone for a period of about 30 minutes, went to work on search warrants. Officer Stratman only reinitiated contact with Mr. Davis because he walked back in that booking canteen area and saw Mr. Davis basically slumped over on the table. He appeared to be asleep. And based on the facts of the case involving heroin and fentanyl, Officer Stratman was worried about Mr. Davis's well-being, feared a possible overdose. The incident at the car stop where Mr. Davis had emptied the substance he was carrying in the car into the orange juice in the cup holder. Officer Stratman feared that ingested some of that substance via contact. And so Officer Stratman reinitiated communication just to confirm Mr. Davis's well-being.
Did the money question occur before or after that?
After that. And so the invocation of the right to silence occurred around 10:30 a.m. We know that Officer Stratman left him alone for approximately 30 minutes, and so that takes us to about 11 a.m. And so all we know in terms of a timeline is that the question about the money occurred sometime between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m., because it's at 1 p.m. that Mr. Davis changes his mind, and that's the point that he reapproaches the officers and says, basically says, I've reassessed my situation. I'd like to speak somewhere more privately. We don't know precisely where in that two-hour time span the money question came in, but we know it was somewhere in those 2 hours. As one of the court's questions earlier mentioned, of course, Mr. Davis was read a fresh set of Miranda warnings at the Central Vice Unit. That obviously weighs in our favor under Mosley. And this court on the third factor, whether the second interrogation was restricted to a crime not subject to the first, this court in Davey versus Mitchell said that factor has very limited applicability in a case where the defendant is the one who reinitiates interrogation, as Mr. Davis did here. And I would note the interrogation at the gang unit was simply, was very, very strictly limited to the question about the money. The interrogation at the Central Vice Unit was much broader in scale, led by TFA Baker, about the federal investigation overall. So very different subject matters and scope of interrogation. Your Honors, I believe I've addressed the points raised by my friend. I would welcome any additional questions from the court, but otherwise I will rest on my brief and ask the court to affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Opposing counsel, the last case cited to is Davey versus Mitchell. That's a case that he relies on, and that is the only case from this circuit that talks about the Michigan v. Mosley standard and talks about the idea that that reinitiating a interrogation about the same case may not be a constitutional violation. It needs to be remembered that in Michigan versus Mosley, the second interrogation was about a completely different case. The defendant invoked his right to remain silent, and then it was a completely separate case where these so-called Mosley factors come into play, where this several-part test comes into play. It's not initiation on the same case. The Davey case cannot stand for the proposition that this is constitutionally sound for several reasons. Number one, Davies a split opinion. It's out of the three judges, there's an opinion, there's a concurrence, and there's a dissent. Second, it's a habeas case. And so they're only reviewing whether the Ohio Supreme Court followed AEDPA standards when it made its decision about that case. And specifically, they limit themselves to the habeas review of that and then hold that it might not be. But certainly, this court has found that in a habeas case, this court doesn't pronounce new rules of constitutional law. And so...
So your opponent really was focusing on Roberson, Hurst, as, in his view, indicating or holding that it's not a violation of Miranda to provide factual updates. How do you respond to those cases?
Yeah, so the those cases don't stand for that proposition. So we have in Robers, we do have the police officer in that case did make one statement with regards to an update with regards to the case, but it wasn't a continuing update of all the things that were going on in the case. And it's differentiated from this case because in this case we already had a constitutional violation that occurred before the updates ever occurred. So it's a completely different character in this case than it would be in Rovers because you didn't have the violation of the right to silence before the updates ever occurred. So that's what differentiates it from that case.
So do you have a good case that you would pose in opposition to your opponent's cases that would say that updates cannot be undertaken?
Yes. So take a look at Fleming v. Metrish, which is actually cited by the government in this case. And that was yet another habeas case. And I see my time is up, but if I can just give 15 seconds on Fleming. So in that case, the defendant or the officer did come back and was saying things like, do the right thing and we've got this, and, you know, things to try to prod him along and update him on the case. But in the court in Fleming said, we're going to affirm this because, again, it's on habeas review and the state court didn't clearly lose its way under AEDPA standards. But the quote of the court is that were Fleming's appeal a direct one and reviewed de novo, which this is, the possibility exists that we might have agreed with Fleming's position. So in Fleming, under a similar factual scenario, under the correct review, this court says that this is a problem.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your argument, and the case will be submitted, and the court will take a very brief recess.